Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Got a chat to Rory Smith at around about 9:30 around Portsmouth. They have new owners, the owner of Disney, and he's trying to revitalise the club and get them back to where they once were. Remember, they won the FA Cup a decade ago, so that coming up shortly. We're going to hear a little bit from Keith Andrews as well. The Keith Andrews Show live every single Thursday on youtube.com/offtheball. He was talking about Declan Rice, and maybe we should be getting worried that we're going to have a Jack Grealish Mark II with Declan Rice and with Michael Obafemi. I'll get to that in a moment. Some of the other stories today, Kevin, Jose Mourinho signed a contract extension until 2020 with the option of a further year. Everybody's expectation when Mourinho arrived at United was this was a 3-year gig. He's halfway through that. Like, does this contract change your opinion of maybe Mourinho and United? It is a true love affair that he's going to lay down roots here, that this is the club that in 30 years time when we think of Mourinho we'll associate
with? I'm not convinced yet, but I mean it suggests as well, of course, not winning the title. He's the first place he hasn't won a title yet, and usually in his second season he wins that title. So
has he done a good job?
Spent a lot of money. I think certainly at times last season and even this season, I think the brand of football was better than it was under Louis van Gaal, but only slightly better. I don't necessarily see it as a vast improvement given the amount of money that he's actually spent. And his complaint recently was the lack of money actually being spent. Now all of a sudden there's a huge deal gone in with Alexis Sanchez. I think we always associate transfer dealings as in the amount of money, the outlay for the transfer. It's not necessarily that. We look at United's outlay for wages and things like this. They're right at the top of the tree in world football. So that's
the biggest club in the world. So
yeah, exactly.
Why not?
Exactly. So we know with Alexis Sanchez now, he's now become the highest paid player in the Premier League. So that is the level that they're at. So given their outlay, given the wages that they are paying, you do expect them to be closer to Man City.
Yeah, I sort of
felt, in answer to your question, I'd probably say they probably are where they are, aren't they? Yes, they've improved. I said earlier on, they've improved certainly league position. They're now in a top four position, and he can look at the trophies that he won last year. But realistically, they're still as far behind Manchester City or behind who was Chelsea last season as they were as they ever were.
My sense at the end of last season was that United fans' patience would wear out quite quickly if the style of football was the same this season as last season. Now they've scored a hell of a lot more goals. There's times when the football doesn't seem like it's improved. I do just wonder this time next year, or even pre-Christmas next year, if it's Chelsea, if it's City, if it's Liverpool, if one of these teams turn it on again and they find themselves 12 points behind and they're not playing a Liverpool or City style of football, do then the United supporters start getting a little bit restless?
Yeah, I think you're right in saying that. The way that Liverpool have been playing under Klopp, the way that, of course, Guardiola, City's side are playing, it puts more pressure on him. And given the fact is as well, which is probably, we've not really got into at length over it, we have maybe around the individual games, is maybe lack of desire to go and win a game in those against the big six sides. There's no desire from him to really go and send out an attacking side to go and really try and implement his own style or try and maybe push on and go and say, well, I'll tell you what, now we're better than you, we will actually go and be. He's never done that.
Is your sense the reason he hasn't done that because he doesn't feel he has the quality of attacking players, or is it that maybe he doesn't feel he has the quality of defensive players, that if they were to go more attacking, if they were to take more risks, that actually looking at that back four, maybe there's not the quality that he once had, say, with Chelsea?
There probably is an element of that. I wouldn't deny that. I wouldn't disagree with what you're saying there. But Mourinho has, as always, has reverted to time. You look back across the course of his managerial career, he has predominantly had a defensively structured side that would rather stop side scoring, and we will hopefully nick one goal, clean sheet, first case or worst case scenario, we'll take a 0-0 draw if anything. If we get a goal, great. Get a second goal when they're playing against lesser sides, that usually happens. How many times do we see when he was Chelsea manager against lesser teams that you'd expect to go and get four or five against, get that second goal and that's it. He'll take the best players off and he's quite happy just to get a 2-0 win. So that is the thing you feel when you're going to watch United, even when you speak to a few United fans, the frustration around them is around the fact is that he doesn't necessarily trust or maybe set up a side to go out and beat those bigger big six teams.
Well, Ed Woodward is impressed. He's got himself a new contract till 2020 at the very very least. So the second episode of the Keith Andrews Show was on earlier today, 12:45, Facebook, Periscope, youtube.com/offtheball. Declan Rice and Michael Obafemi and their national allegiances loomed large in the conversation. Of the two players, Keith says Rice is the one that we should really be looking to hang on to.
The initial and more pressing one for me is Declan Rice, because players playing in the Premier League, just gone 19, getting minutes in the Premier League, we don't see, it's a rarity now. And I've seen West Ham 3 times live this year. He's come on 2 of those games, Stoke and Huddersfield only a few weeks ago. He just looks like he was born to play Premier League football. And you were talking about Seamus Coleman, probably doesn't feel he has the right to order people around and get people in and shout and have a go. Declan Rice didn't get that memo.
Right.
Because he is ordering players around.
Fantastic.
Organising his back three, back five, whatever you want to call it. Zabaleta, how many Premier Leagues have you won? Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Get yourself in. I need more cover.
Right.
I am praying that he sticks with us.
Yeah.
And we get him in.
Obafemi's situation was he was born here young to two Nigerian parents and then effectively grew up in the UK and just played for the Irish under-19s.
Yeah.
So look, not to presume anything, I don't know how much time he spent in the country, how committed he ever was. I don't know his family situation beyond what I've just said. Rice has a core
Rice grandparent. Rice is very different. So Rice's grandparents,
right,
stroke parents, unsure,
okay,
are from Cork. He has been involved in our system like Jack Grealish was. All the way through. 16s, 17s, 19s last year in the European Championships, 21s, pivotal member of the 21s. Noel plays him, Noel King plays him centre midfield. I think he'll end up as a centre half.
The worry there is, do you remember the Grealish tide really turned when he put in some really lovely performances, silky touches and dribbling and all the rest of it in some big games? There was an FA Cup semi-final. It was when the Henry Winters and Martin Samuels and Sam Wallaces of the world, when they started writing opinion pieces in national newspapers saying, we got to lock this guy down. Then, regardless of what the England manager at the time thinks, it becomes a PR war. I can't lose this guy. Yeah. The FA think, God, we look really bad if we lose this guy. And they get involved and you have Grealish's dad on TalkSport and the whole thing becomes an absolute mess. Unfortunately, from our point of view, Declan Rice is now getting minutes on Match of the Day. There's now, after quite a few West Ham games, there are Declan Rice segments. So the FA and Gareth Southgate are well aware that the public are now aware of this guy. And that adds an extra layer to how aggressively they go after Rice. And it's not like they're blessed with a billion top centre-halves either.
No, it's not. And it's worrying. It really is worrying because, you know, we're craving positivity, we're craving good news.
Will it be Tony O'Donoghue's fault if Declan Rice plays for England?
Is he working for Match of the Day now?
Is that the interview you did with him, Tony?
It is worrying.
We don't know is the short on Rice.
Yeah.
But England could use him as well long term?
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt.
Okay.
If he declared for Ireland, he's 19 now, I would be amazed. You can never know exactly what way the career is going to put. In terms of sheer ability and temperament, by all accounts, in terms of coaches that I've worked with the FAI, coaches that I've worked with at West Ham that I've spoken with, I'd be amazed if he wasn't captaining Ireland in 5 years' time.
Wow, okay.
He's that good.
Yeah, high praise indeed for Declan Rice from Keith Andrews. Like, were we so shook up by what happened with Jack Grealish that now we're doubting everything before our eyes?
Yeah, there's probably an element to that. Keith quite bullish there. I'd certainly hold reservations to the fact is that I've seen, maybe even during my time, maybe 10 or 15 Declan Rice's, similar if not more ability, that aren't necessarily able to make that step up and have that sort of career ahead of them. But yes, I've
been... But do we not have 10 or 15
Declan Rice's back then, whereas now
we've only one Declan Rice.
Of course, no, you're spot on. You and I watched him at the first game of this season, didn't we, when he came off the bench against Man United, and we spoke about him then. You could see immediately
he came in the middle of midfield, he's demanding the ball straight away off far more experienced players, which was really refreshing from an Irish point of view. Keith touched on it there. Kenny Cunningham mentioned it the night we were at Wembley, when he had Harry Kane in his pocket that night at Wembley, that he's far more of a centre back.
Yeah, I think he is. I think he's more of an organised. That's his position he's played throughout his career, hasn't he? He's played in a three or a two. We were at the under-21 game. It was the Norway game, wasn't it, when we saw him play as a holding midfielder, as a midfielder alongside Josh Cullen that day. And the suggestion was that our 21s could be stronger if he actually went into the back four and played in that position. I don't know whether that's going to be, whether or not he's going to be used. But that's maybe for others maybe to decide long term. But he certainly looks at home playing in a back three, yes, and it is an option for Martin O'Neill if he were to use that sort of system. But just in answer to the original question you were saying about the Jack Grealish issue, as soon as Jack Grealish then decided to move on and make his decision and then decide, look, that's it, Ireland's not for me, it's almost like, personally, I just think, right, okay, fair enough then. I don't agree that you're playing. I think there's got to get a cut-off point. Personally, I wouldn't have played at any level for any other country. But that's my own personal feeling. If you're playing at a certain level, and you're certainly playing at under 21 level, in my eyes, that's it. It shouldn't even be an issue then. That is it. You've actually declared for a certain country. Certainly if you've played at senior level, as we've seen certainly across various internationals now, even ourselves, we've had players that have played for us and gone off to play for different nations. But I think now Declan Rice has played on the 21 level. He's not a kid. He's not 13, 14.
He's been in with the senior squad.
Yes, exactly. So I think
a very different situation, though, from when you were growing up. So Declan Rice is one of, I think it's 12 English-born players currently involved with the under-21s.
Yeah.
And that night at Wembley, it was interesting listening to him speak in some of the post-match interviews where they get a journalist maybe from the London Evening Standard saying, oh, Declan Rice. It's a very Irish name. And Declan Rice like, yeah, well, yes, I'm playing for Ireland.
Exactly. Well, that's the ignorance of it, isn't it?
Not thinking about England, are you? And he was, no, listen, I've been in, I'm looking forward to getting back in with March. He was probably talking about the under-21s because like, they're going along quite nicely. But you grew up in an environment around Preston, around Manchester, where you were very much part of a strong Irish community. Your Sundays were spent at the Irish club.
Yeah.
So you knew very much that your heritage was Irish.
Yeah.
We haven't spoken to Declan Rice, but Declan Rice was born in London. He qualifies through his grandparents are from Cork. He may not have had that upbringing.
Possibly, yeah.
So we have in Mark O'Toole, the FAI scout, somebody who's clearly very good at his job, at talent identification, that he can go and somehow spot Declan Rice, who has a bit of a Cockney accent. Michael Obafemi, who doesn't have a particularly Irish name, who also has a very Cockney accent, and somehow manages to work out that these players are eligible to play for Ireland. And we don't know what those conversations he's having when Declan Rice is 16 is, and when Michael Obafemi is 15, 16. Perhaps the conversation is, listen, you're qualified to play for Ireland. We'd love to have you on board. Come over. If you don't like it, that's perfectly fine. If you feel like you want to play for England, if you feel like you want to play for Nigeria, here, that's perfectly fine. We won't stand in your way. You're not stuck with us. But come over, give it a try. Maybe you'll like it.
Yeah.
And you're 15, 16, and you come over and you do like it. Suddenly, here, listen, I'm playing international football that I've not been offered with England. But by the time you get to 19, and in Declan Rice's case, maybe some of those young lads at a very good academy at West Ham are starting to be called up to the England under-21 squad, and you're looking at them and thinking, well, they're my mates. And I was born in England, and actually I feel more of a bond with them. All right, I went over to Ireland and I've really enjoyed it, and they've done nothing wrong. But actually, now that I've thought about it, now that I've matured, I want to play for England. Like, we can't have a problem with that, can we?
I take your point, what you're saying. I'd probably disagree, certainly the level that he's played at. But no, I totally know what you're saying, that ultimately if he thinks it'll benefit him, fair play to him. I would never want to dictate to any player and you know, try to instill my beliefs upon them. It's entirely their decision. I think I felt at the time when Jack Grealish made his decision, I felt that it was the wrong decision he was making. And I think we're
almost been very unfair on Declan Rice
conversation. We're just basically surmising something here. But we know, as you said before, you said it right at the start, we've been scarred, haven't we? So we know. But also, as well, I mean, you know, there'd be a lot of Northern Ireland fans that could throw something at us that you know, we've taken players off them. It's a different case, and I'll say, I totally get
they're
that.
They're totally entitled to play for the Republic of Ireland if they're born in Northern
Ireland. But they'd say they've played at youth level as well. I know it's totally different, but it is a slightly different scenario, and I get that totally. The Declan Rice, when I say we're guessing, but as maybe Joe pointed out something brilliant there, as soon as you're getting highlighted and, you know, they're doing runs on you on Match of the Day, and the journals, the big journals that follow the English side are talking about you, it certainly puts you in a different light. Gareth Southgate's all all of a sudden, I think I've seen him at a few of the West Ham games. Now, whether or not it's Declan Rice or whether or not it's been opposition sides that West Ham have been playing against that he's keeping a check on, but he is Gareth Southgate. Within his right, he wouldn't be doing his job if he wasn't actually trying to explore all avenues, as we do ourselves in trying to get the best players that's eligible to play for us, yeah.
Yeah, because Declan Rice is the youngest player to start a Premier League game this season, and he started a number of Premier League games. So, as you say, Gareth Southgate is dead right to be going and looking at this situation. Like, Michael Obafemi is probably, again, a slightly different situation. There's reports in Nigeria that he's decided to go and play for Nigeria, saying he travelled with us to Abuja. He was the best player for Team Nigeria UK. Just last week, we got a call from his mother that he wants to change. He wants to play for Nigeria, for not Ireland. That was allnigeriasoccer.com that was in. So, listen, we wait and see. But again, there's so few young players coming through. And it is that sort of Sky Sports phenomenon. So Declan Rice comes on against Manchester United on the opening day. Me and you were very excited at Old Trafford about this. I didn't see anybody else getting excited teenager when West Ham are 4-0 down coming on for the final 20 minutes. But he does it on a Thursday night against the England striker live in Sky Sports at Wembley. Suddenly everybody's on it. If Michael Obafemi had scored that goal with the chance for Southampton, a 17-year-old, 2 minutes into his debut, like, every English newspaper is getting very excited. But again, I do wonder with Obafemi, in the culture he's grown up in London, again, maybe he is part of the Irish community, or maybe he's grown up in the Nigerian community, which is very strong right now, probably where the Irish community was 20, 30 years ago. And that's the bond he feels. And if it is, like, I don't have a problem with that.
No, I don't
think we should be going, listen, you came to us when you were 16, 17, we give you your chance.
Yeah.
No, listen.
Well, there's an element of that. There's an argument for that, though. There is. Personally, as I said before, it wouldn't have been my makeup whatsoever. I wouldn't have even thought about it for any other nation. That's just the way that I am. Obafemi's a different one. I do agree. I spoke to Victor Anachibi when he was at Everton, when he was just breaking through. And although Scouse accent, I'm Nigerian, pretty much along the lines of how I felt growing up. So you have to respect the decision in how they're feeling. So there's no issues. Again, there's no issues with me. I just think overall, certainly when, if you're looking at a Jack Grealish where we've been scarred, yes, he played 21 level. Personally, I think you're old enough to make a decision at that stage, and you shouldn't be playing at that level if you're then having some sort of thoughts or you're contemplating going to play for another nation.
If you're coming over collecting the under 21 player of the year award.
Oh, totally. And then it's not so much giving people false hope, but you're talking about, I'm proud to get this award. I'm proud. Then I'm looking forward to my future. Cause that was along the lines of the interview with Jack Grealish at that time. And then you go and then revert to a different way. Now I understand you're in a difficult situation. You've got to answer the questions as best you can, but personally I think once you're playing 21 level, I think that's it. I mean, again, I'd make the argument that it should be 15 16 17, that once you've made that declaration, you're actually there. But I understand what you're saying.
I just think
on.
They're a bit young at 15 16 no, yeah, 17 when I, someone's maybe coming asking you, do you want to come and play with no pressure?
Look at Aidan McGeady, would he have played for us? I don't know. Again, I've not really had this conversation with him, but I know that Paki Bono was instrumental in getting him at the time. Brian Kerr then pulled him in, we capped him when he was still only about 18 at the time, I think, when he got capped at international level. But certainly when he was at 15 and the structure of Scottish football was different, even with James McCarthy as well, we managed to get these lads over the line, and it was almost, yeah, we've given you the chance. And to be fair to those two, they were loyal and they have stayed with us. Again, these two situations may be exactly the same. They may stay loyal to us and they may want to go and play for us further down the line. But I think once now we have, of course, been scarred in recent years, that it certainly clouds our thinking, yeah.
Declan Rice, you put him in the squad for the game against Turkey?
Yeah, I think he deserves it now. I do, yeah.
Like, that's not even a token gesture. That's not trying to get him to commit.
It's not
actually. He's a centre-back playing in the Premier League week in, week out. He deserves to be there.
Yeah, exactly. I think he does it. You say there, he's playing. If he's not starting, he's certainly the go-to guy. He's the first substitute that David Moyes is bringing on. Change your system, he can play in two different systems as well. I think he's the ideal one, and yep, totally agree with you. I think it's not as if you say, no, this lad has played a couple of games, let's get him capped. It's not for that issue. He's good enough to be in the squad now.
Colin wondering, is the fact that Declan Rice's Twitter bio only lists West Ham and Nike UK a bad sign for us? No mention of Ireland.
I didn't know that. Yeah,
this is the paranoia we get into.
No, it is. It's true, but it's right, though, isn't it? Because again, we've been scarred. So
with Jack Grealish, Tim Sherwood very much seemed to be pushing him towards the England route in terms of what it could do for his market value and also what it could do for his own value in terms
I don't agree, that's bollocks. I'm not having that, but anyway, that's for another day, isn't it, as well.
You don't think English players are valued higher than Irish players?
Yeah, but they are, yeah, but I just don't. If you're thinking like that, then you shouldn't have come and play for us in the first place. That's what I think, if that's in your thought.
Yeah, I don't get the sense David Moyes is going to be having that conversation with Declan Rice.
No. I mean, David Moyes knew me from when I was a boy. David Moyes was around Everton the time that I was called up for England, and he would have been certainly a player at the time. He was club captain. He'd have been a player that would have been advising me when I was a young lad. Very fortunate that would have had someone like him around me. So, very, very proud Scotsman, and he understood how I felt at that time. Yeah.
Yeah, listen, we've actually no real reason to suspect that Declan Rice is going to go.
No, there is reason. There is, we know, there's history of it. So,
well, there is history
of it. Not so much with Declan himself, though, no.
So that friendly is at the end of March, so the squad will probably be announced sometime around the beginning of March, and hopefully his name is in it. Next up, we're going to talk to Rory Smith about Portsmouth.
Off the ball.
In association with AIR. Watch live Allianz League's GAA action this weekend on the AIR Sport Pack with a Dublin hurling and football doubleheader at Croke Park.
This is News Talk.
This is Diarra. And here's Utaka. Owen Carter's there. But no. Is it given? Assistant referee stands where he is. Mike Dean walks away. And Cardew and Portsmouth think they've taken the lead.
Well, they have, haven't they?
And Portsmouth have won the FA Cup for the first time since 1939. And Harry Redknapp has led them into Europe for the first time. Redknapp rules the waves in the naval town of Portsmouth.
A lifetime in the game. How sweet is this moment?
Yeah, fantastic, John. I mean, for everybody, my family especially, the fans, the players, it's great. You know, it's been a difficult year off the field. So to come here now and win the FA Cup, it's a dream come true to me.
How much is this for your wife, Sandra, and of course, Pat, who sadly passed away?
Well, very much. We're a very close family, so it's all my grandchildren up there and everybody. It's been a good day for them, so it's fantastic.
Yeah, it is almost 10 years now since Portsmouth's greatest moment, FA Cup winners in 2008. Nwankwo Kanu scoring the only goal in the win over Cardiff. And what a team it was for Portsmouth. Managed by Harry Redknapp, David James, Glenn Johnson, Sol Campbell, Sylvain Distan, Herman Hreidsen, Las Diarra, John Utaka, Pedro Mendes, Nico Kranjčar, Sully Montari, Nwankwo Kanu.
Played against that team, yeah.
Yeah, decent.
Yeah, very good. Strong side. Very, very strong side. Good side.
It all went very horribly wrong over the last decade for Portsmouth. They found themselves on the verge of going out of business, found themselves down in League Two. But it seems that they're on the way back again. They've been bought by a company headed up by the former Disney chief executive, Michael Eisner. And Rory Smith, chief soccer correspondent for the Irish Times, for the New York Times, even the Irish Times, hey, it's all the same, you know, good gig either way. From the New York Times, Rory Smith is on the line. Thanks for joining us, Rory.
I've just been promoted to the Irish Times.
He's all soccer, you know, that's it.
I know. So you've been writing about this and how Portsmouth may be on the way back. They're currently in League One. But as you were looking at the state of Portsmouth over the last decade, like the names that come up, Mandarich, Gaidamak, Suleiman Al-Fahim, Al-Faraj, like these are names that are almost now synonymous as models of mismanagement. Where did it all ultimately go wrong for Portsmouth?
Well, I think that the problem is, and they're not the only team that's found this, is that when you have one bad owner, often the only people who can rescue you from that are more bad owners. So Mandarich, I think you kind of have to separate him a little bit. Mandarich isn't maybe the greatest owner in the world, but he kind of knows what he's doing. He sells to the Gaidamak, the money there is of dubious origin. Their purpose was always a little bit kind of cloudy. They then want to... I think they were forced to sell up. You then get people coming in whose motives aren't clear. They were sold to people who didn't have any money. One of them, I mean, Ali Al-Faraj, there is a bit of a question mark over whether he actually exists. He was always nicknamed Al Mirage at the time. You then get other people coming in claiming loans, using the club as collateral, and you just get this sort of bad money being thrown after bad money, this cycle. And ultimately what happens is you hit rock bottom and everything falls out of the club effectively, and the only reason the club still exists at all for anyone to buy, is because the fans stepped forward and saved it themselves, and for 5 years it was under fan ownership, and they did sink to League Two, but at least they still had a club to support. And in that sense, kind of what's happened to Portsmouth is, on one hand, a massive cautionary tale about foreign investment and the kind of, not even foreign investment, but in the wrong sort of investment, mm-hmm. and the dangers of chasing the dream. But on the other, it's actually quite a heartwarming one about the power of a community and a city to rescue this massive institution and at least keep it alive, if not at the level that it once hit.
Was that what Harry Redknapp was doing at that time, 10 years ago? Was he chasing the dream when they were spending huge money on transfer fees and wages to bring in the likes of Peter Crouch, Sylvain Distin, Glenn Johnson, that he was talking to the owners who were willing to go and do whatever it took to get to the next level? Was he just following orders?
I think it's really easy to insult Harry, and I'm one of the very few journalists in the world who doesn't have a relationship with him. But I think what Redknapp has always done, if you look at every club he's been at, is that he's not a man who's going to say no. So if he has an owner who he feels is kind of willing or encouraging him to go and spend money, then Harry Redknapp will go and spend that money. He doesn't necessarily think about things like the long term and the future and whether the money might run out. And I think at quite a few clubs, Birmingham being the most recent example, he's maybe allowed that desire to compete, to put it in a nice way, to kind of just to take over. He's got carried away with it. I don't think anybody at Portsmouth at the time could look back now and think it was a sensible model of how to run a football club, or that it was kind of natural, organic growth. They chased the dream, and they achieved it. They were a Premier League fixture for five or six years. They won the FA Cup. Those are things that the fans, I'm sure, will cherish. But obviously, you then get the hangover and the subsequent 10 years almost in the wilderness, where the club could have gone out of business. And I think, again, without necessarily wanting to criticise Redknapp particularly, I don't think the problems that Portsmouth have had should be traced mainly to Harry Redknapp signing Jermaine Defoe or Nico Crankia. Mm. If you get Harry Redknapp, he will sign Nico Crankia. That just comes as part of the package. But he definitely didn't kind of. Having him there at that time probably didn't help because of the type of manager that he is. But the problems came with the owners and the nature of the money of the owners and the people they were selling to, and their motives for getting involved, really. That was the issue, rather than the fact that Harry Redknapp was willing to then say, well, look, we've got this money, let's spend it.
The nadir probably came around 2012, 2013, when they dropped down to League Two, an automatic 10-point deduction, went into administration for a second time. Just how close did Pompey come to going out of business?
Probably as close as a football club can. I mean, the thing is, having written about various clubs, leads among them that have kind of come close to collapsing, fans do generally sort of get worried that the club won't exist anymore. And in a normal business, I think they would go out of business. But for some reason in football, it doesn't seem to apply. And there is always some sort of last-minute deal. I mean, in England, for all the talk of, you know, the dangers of chasing the dream and the dangers of money and the fact that clubs aren't run well, the last club to actually go out of business was Aldershot in 1992, I think. No club has gone since then. There is always a way of them being saved. Pompey came closer than pretty much anybody else, I would say, to bucking that trend and actually going out of business. But as I say, at that point, the fans stepped in, along with these, I think, 16 superfans who agreed to put in larger stakes than everybody else. They had 3,000 owners, and it's actually been pretty stable for the last 5 years. You know, they haven't been paying big wages, they haven't been in the Premier League, but they have been, to an extent, a success story and proof that at a certain level, fan ownership can and does work.
And they got back to League One last season under Paul Cook. What then was the attraction for Michael Eisner, a man who had enormous success with Disney, within sport as well, with clubs in Anaheim, a club in League One, with that fan ownership structure that they seem to be quite happy with probably an ageing stadium? What was it that attracted him to Portsmouth?
Well, that's why I wanted to write about it. Obviously, I mean, Eisner, he's famous on this side of the Atlantic, but I don't think we maybe don't recognise just how big a name he was in US business and US sport for quite a long time. He was kind of one of the business gurus, really, running Disney, running Paramount, running ABC, all these massive Hollywood studios, making all these films. He was a massive figure. And I think that's something that's lost a little bit. But I think what appealed to him about Portsmouth is that he's dealt his entire life in stories, and all of the movies that Disney produced while he was there, the sports movies, there were all these sort of these great underdog stories of the, you know, the little teams that could, and the Mighty Ducks, and Remember the Titans, and all these slightly cheesy films, but you know, with the underlying message of, you know, the little team triumphs in the end through willpower and heart and all this stuff. And I think when he decided to invest in sport, and he wanted to invest in sport because, like all Americans, he thinks it's they call it time decayed media content. It's the last thing you have to watch live. We don't have to watch anything live anymore, but you have to watch sport live. So that's why it has a value. He looked at US sports, thought they were all overpriced. Looked in the Premier League. He came close, I think, to doing a deal with a Premier League club, but was gazumped by a Chinese offer. And then he thought, well, actually, this isn't kind of what I do. I don't go in at the top. He likes building things up from the bottom. He says, and he's perfectly right, because the reward is greater than the risk. It's better to have a low floor than a high ceiling. That might be the wrong way around. It might be a high floor than a low ceiling. Anyway, if you spend 600 million quid on a Premier League team, you can lose a lot of money. Mm. If you spend 10 million quid on a League Two team, you're not going to lose very much money at all, because you've not put a huge amount in. Whereas the reward can be quite great. But I think that the thing that really appealed to him was the story of this club that had been to the brink and come back, and the fact that he could then write this extra chapter where suddenly he takes them back to the promised land. That's a great story, and he is a man who thinks in terms of stories, and I think that's the appeal for him. And Portsmouth, he looked at six or seven teams, but Portsmouth, maybe more than any other, has that narrative arc behind it that appealed to him, and he seems quite taken with it. And it, because of Portsmouth history, and speaking to fans, I think this is quite important, they didn't want another faceless billionaire or millionaire coming in and investing, because they don't have anything to lose. Eisner, because he's well known, has a reputation, which means he's got skin in the game. He's got something to lose. So if he screws Portsmouth over, then it's Michael Eisner doing the dirty on Portsmouth. It's not some Russian that no one's heard of. It's Michael Eisner. He has a reputation to maintain, which means Portsmouth has a degree of protection in the transaction. He had to persuade all 3,000 fans, or 75% of 3,000 fans, to sell their stakes to him. He got 87% eventually. And I think the crucial thing there is that they know that if it all goes wrong, and it goes wrong because of malicious intent rather than incompetence or bad luck, then Eisner suffers as well. And I think that was quite important too.
Yeah, Rory, you probably just beat me to it there, I suppose. I just wanted just to ask you around that sale then as well, given the fact is that the club then got them back on a financial stability, how difficult a sell then was that then to the Pompey Supporters Trust to sell the club then to Eisner, and for him then to give his vision for the club going forward?
I think it was tricky. I think they'd recognised that there's a limit to how far they could take Portsmouth. They'd already taken them to League One by the time he bought them. I guess the difference in budgets between League One and League Two isn't massive. You could probably take a fan-owned club out of League One into the Championship, but beyond that, everything, you know, the trajectory gets really steep, so everything suddenly gets really expensive. And I think they recognised that to compete in the Championship, they needed more money. So they had to sell. And as I say, I think the fact that he was well-known, he was a well-known figure, that maybe broke the door down a little bit to persuade them, all right, this is someone who can't really afford to mess us around like Al-Fahim or Ali Al-Faraj or Chansiri before them, or even the Gaidamax to an extent. But he still had to sell himself and his vision to the club, and the way that he sold it was to say, we're not going to do what has happened before. We're not going to promise anything. We're not going to say we're going to spend loads of money on players. We're not going to say we can get you to the Premier League in 3 years' time. It will be slow and it will be steady. And I think that hearing someone talk sensibly about not a slow motion plan, but a sort of gradual growth rather than a boom and bust, that maybe made enough of them feel safe to think, right, this is someone we can trust with this club. But I'm pretty sure that everyone at the Portsmouth Supporters Trust in particular, and all of the former owners, will be keeping a really close eye on everything Eisner does, because they have been burned so badly before. And it's little things, I think, in that situation that really helped. So someone I spoke to said that he replies to quite a lot of emails from fans. You know, he will take the time to write a personal reply. And I think to fans, that's a really easy thing to do. I mean, the people who buy football are pretty busy.
It does mean a lot to supporters. to have that connection.
And to feel that your voice is being heard, and if you own a football club and you've got millions of dollars, then you're a busy man. You know, you don't have a load of free time. Although, having said that, the president seems to have quite a lot of free time, so maybe you're not that busy. But it's a very simple thing that does have a huge impact. If fans sense that you are listening, even if you're not, as long as they feel that you're listening, it will buy you time. And it's easy to think, oh, it's a simple PR trick, and to an extent it probably is, but it does buy you goodwill, and it does buy you patience and understanding. And I think Eisner kind of instinctively gets that he can't afford to be distant and a kind of absentee landlord in the way that some American owners, Hicks and Gillette at Liverpool particularly, has been, the Glazers as well at Man United. I think he feels that he needs to have a presence on the ground. He's really praising of his chief executive, Mark Catlin, who was there under the fans' trust. He's really impressed by him. He does the day-to-day running. But there is a sense that Eisner is involved, and I think that's really important to the fans. They'll keep him straight as much as they can, but it's a huge risk selling something that you've saved and protected to an unknown quantity. And as I say, without repeating myself, the fact that he is known and he is a person who has a reputation, I think that's really important in the fact that the sale went through.
Rory, great stuff. Thanks as always for taking the call.
Thanks, Rory.
Always a pleasure.
All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll wrap up the show.
Off the Ball.
In association with AIR. Watch live Allianz League's GAA action this weekend on the AIR Sport Pack with a Cork hurling and football doubleheader at Parky Queeve.
This is News Talk.
All right, so that is us almost done for the football show for this week. You're on FA Cup duty for the weekend.
I am. Football Focus Saturday, yeah. Yeah, Saturday.
It's not a very good fourth round of the FA Cup. There's not a decent game between them.
No, it starts on Friday, isn't it? Yeovil, live on TV. Yeah, Yeovil, Man United. Man United, you know, it's a big tie for Yeovil. That's the thing there. You know, if you're a fan of Yeovil, it'd be great for them. But yeah, Newport County.
Tottenham against Spurs. On Spurs, Lucas Moura, the Telegraph reporting, at their training ground. Possible move from Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah, I know. Good one. Yes, so Jean-Mario as well, signed for West Ham today on loan. So particularly that one. That'll be an exciting one for Spurs fans, that one there. Because he's
a bit of something different.
Yeah, he's not necessarily been able to fulfil that potential there at PSG just with the amount of players that they've signed. So yeah, very direct. Yeah, powerful.
All quick. Right. Kev will be back with us as well on Saturday. Keith Andrews in studio will be talking about the FA Cup. We'll bring you through everything else that's happening on tomorrow evening's show. But tomorrow morning, OTBAM will be talking to Jim Walden, the lawyer for Grigory Rodchenkov, who lifted the lid on Russia's state-sponsored doping program. The lads are live from 7:45 on Facebook, Periscope and youtube.com/offtheball. Turn on your notifications now for Off the Ball. You will not miss a single second. Tomorrow night, former Cork boss Kieran Kingston will be looking ahead to the new Hurling League season. Niall O'Toole will be talking about child abuse in swimming and his encounter with the accused sex abuser George Gibney. Richie is up next. He is in for Tom Dunn. Good night.